The hour having arrived, I will call the meeting to order and welcome back everyone, and appreciate everyone getting here today on a nice cold day. And since Representative Quam was kind of giving me a bad time earlier in the meeting, I'm going to call on him to approve the minutes because I'm sure he's properly prepared and read them thoroughly from last April 12th. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have reviewed the minutes, and I would move that we approve them as they presently are.
Very good. Representative Quam has moved to the April 12, 2013 minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carried. Again, welcome back, everyone, and I think a couple comments here as we start a new season is that I think sometimes we don't always think about always the perspective of things that we do here. And whether or not it's Republicans in control or Democrats in control, education is always a top priority, and the work that is done here is very, very important. And I thought about it on December 3rd when there was a groundbreaking for the Viking Stadium. And everyone is lauding the $1 billion project, the largest public project, state-funded type of thing ever. And yet, if you remember last year when Rob Grunewald was here from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, he said that if we could close the achievement gap for students of color and students of poverty, within 15 years, that would improve the gross domestic product by about 2%. And when you look at 2%, that is about, in today's dollars, about $5 billion of increased activity. That would be having the equivalent to five Viking stadiums being built a year. Now, we don't have to put it in Viking Stadium, but
that's
it's
crazy.
That. It's the magnitude is what I'm getting at here. And I know as far as this group here that closing that achievement gap is, I think, almost unanimous, the top thing that we are doing as Democrats and Republicans. And so just how important that work is that we do here and the work we did last year and the work we're looking forward to doing this year, I just, again, want to say thank you to all the members from the excellent work we did last year. I just enjoyed it. I thought we made a lot of progress. The things we do here are very, very important. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Since you used the Vikings analogy, I was wondering if you were advocating that students should just go to school 8 days a year then.
And Representative Hertaus, would we charge them for a seating fee? So, very good. Representative O'Driscoll is here. He is first on the agenda, and if members remember, a couple years ago, he and Representative Dietrich worked very hard on the trust land funding and all that type of thing to try to get more dollars into the classroom. And Representative Dietrich is, former Representative Dietrich is also here, so they worked bipartisanly very, very hard on that and put a lot of great work there. So welcome to the committee, Representative. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, I think we are honored today by the presence of the only Republican chair in the entire state of Minnesota. So I would like to, as the chair of the Land Trust Committee, he is the only Republican that chairs a committee today. So
I didn't realize that. That's very good.
I just wanted to honor that.
Mr. Chair, if you would, Chair O'Driscoll, if you...
Oh, the promotions just keep coming this morning. It's amazing. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be able to be here. And I think it's a special honor to be the first order of business before the E-12 Finance Committee here this session. You're exactly right. In 2012, Representative Dietrich and I set off on a long adventure with a number of other legislators and a past history to try to help improve the management of the school trust lands here in the state of Minnesota. And just to, in the way of a little bit of a background, when the state of Minnesota was allowed by federal government to be granted statehood, we needed to set aside at least one section of land in each township. And a township measures 36 square miles, one section of land, 1 mile by 1 mile. containing about 640 acres for the benefit of school children here in the state of Minnesota. And I always tell people when they say, well, how does that work? How do you quantify that? So if you remember the television show, The Little House on the Prairie, and the Ingalls girls went to the little schoolhouse, that is the concept back in the Enabling Act and how we did education back then. That plot of land that schoolhouse was on generated income. That income helped to pay for the school supplies, helped to pay for the teacher in the classroom. The good news is education has advanced since then, and Minnesota's always been a leader in advancing education. Minnesota actually doubled down and put two sections of land, so a little over 1,200, almost 1,300 acres of property in each township set aside for education and benefit of public school children here in the state of Minnesota. And it's held in trust, and that means that those are lands that are held in a special account, without getting into the legalities of it, for the purpose of benefiting public education. And each one of us, as members of the legislature, the governor, are charged as trustees, and we have a high duty under the law to manage those properties for the purpose of providing money for education here in the state of Minnesota. A few years ago, the state law would use the school trust lands as offset money for general fund money. So in simple terms, if the school district was to receive from the state of Minnesota $100,000 in general fund money to be able to provide education for the local district, and that school district is entitled to $2,000 of school trust lands, they would still get their $100,000, but $2,000 of that would come from school trust lands and $98,000 from the school from the state's general fund. A few years ago, that law was changed so that that school district would still receive their $100,000 from the general fund and the $2,000 that they would have otherwise been entitled to from the school trust lands for a total of $102,000. And that doesn't seem like an awful lot, and I know that in your packets you've got information about how your respective districts are doing. On average, the fund generates a little over $25 million net revenue, or net income, I should say, for the benefit of school children. And when you think about, there's about 1 million school children in the state of Minnesota. Each district gets about $25 per pupil to be able to use to help offset education. Right now, those dollars are left at the local level to be able to decide what to do with those dollars, how to be able to fund things that are important priorities to those school districts. The work that the legislature did in 2012 was to put in a legislative commission consisting of 6 members from the House, 6 members from the Senate, 3 from each party, for a total of 12 members. And we also crafted the legislation in such a way that there would never ever be a Republican bias or balance or a Democrat bias or balance. That would be for the kids in the state of Minnesota. And within that committee, they will actually elect who their chair is going to be. So we wanted to leave it rather autonomous to try to keep the politics out of education as best we could. We recently received in December 31st of 2013, the DNR was supposed to deliver a report to us telling us how they performed with those assets in the previous calendar year, or the previous fiscal year ending June 30th of 2013. That report literally hit my email at about 10 o'clock yesterday morning, as well as commission members. And later this session, when the commission gets together, it will get a formal presentation from the DNR as to the dollars that are spent. I'm here to tell you that we've made some progress, but there's still many, many miles to go in helping to manage these funds in such a way that they would be able to continue to benefit the school students and public education here in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, Mr. Chair, that's kind of a quick update. And if there are any questions, I will have one kind of maybe follow-up or summation at the end of the testimony today.
Thank you very much. Any question? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Hey, thanks for your work on this, Tim. And the, you know, one of the things, and maybe you covered it, but what has the income from the school trust land gone up substantially since we made the change? You kind of talked a little bit about it, but could you elaborate on it? I mean, is it a 10% increase, or are schools seeing a 10%, 5%, or, you know, any increase in terms of the different management approach that we have now versus what we had before?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, it's sort of difficult to quantify the amount of dollars that are coming in as a percentage at this point. We're pretty much holding our own at this. One of the things we have to remember is what the assets are that are used in this. It's oftentimes forestry products. where you have timber that's mined and harvested and sold into the marketplace, as well as minerals that are out there, because those are the two major assets. What we've seen happen in timber prices in the state of Minnesota in the last 18 months has basically bottomed out. And so, because we've had a number of paper mills that have closed, and Representative Anzels has one in his district that closed. I had one in my district that closed, which affects the overall market. And then when market's affected, so is price on that. So we've been able to hold constant the dollars that are being paid out. But I can tell you that the overall corpus, which is when you sell the assets and you bring the income in, and the kids are kind of living off the dividends and interest that are coming on here, we have crossed the $1 billion asset mark this past year as well. So that doesn't exactly answer your question as the percentage, because there's a lot of inputs that are going in there. But it is moving, and it's tough to move that battleship in the middle of the water.
Very good.
Just to follow up.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Markert. Thanks for that response. But what, you know, the total income versus the total assets, are we getting a 1% return or two and a half? Okay. Evidently, you've got somebody giving me answers sitting next to me.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Part of that information will be presented to the commission in the report. I have not had a chance to read the 48-page report, as I said, that hit my my email yesterday about 10 o'clock. So
okay.
we'll get better insight as to the line items and expenses and revenues on that. And I can't either confirm or deny what Representative Hertas has said as far as the returns on that. So,
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, this might be premature because you've not been able to read the report yet. But I'm concerned about the inventory of lands and whether or not the commission has gotten a chance to review that and what changes might be seen, because I always have a concern that we're not quite getting the facts on the inventory, and because I know of land in my district that for some reason it doesn't show up on the school trust inventory, and yet it is.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Erickson, you bring up a very good question. One of the things that the legislation did in 2012 was require the DNR to do a complete inventory of trust lands that they have, and they are openly admitting that they've had some difficulty identifying at points within parcels of land or within areas exactly how much trust land is owned by the trust. They have been able to identify that. That is a part of another presentation and report that we will get. And in addition to that, it asks to prioritize the lands. What does the state want to keep as assets the public? What are going to be the resources that may be used for future mining? What are the resources that may be used for future forestry? And right on down the line. And they are going to be presenting that with us as well. Also, as a part of that, the requirement is that if it is something that is deemed to be held in the trust right now and is still of an asset class that the state would like to hold in the public realm, that the state of Minnesota would actually buy that from the trust lands. And sometimes people scratch their head and they say, well, wait a second, these are all public lands. They are and they are not. They are publicly held lands for the benefit of the school kids in the state of Minnesota by the Enabling Act to allow us to become a state. It's in a trust. It's a different class of assets. We, again, are trustees responsible for managing those assets as legislators and as the governor. But to take those assets and say, well, we're just going to set those aside right now because they're already held in the public, that's sort of like someone saying, well, I'm going to just move into your basement because you're my neighbor and not pay any rent or not pay you anything. And that's what this is when the state wants to use or preserve these assets on the backs of the school kids in the state of Minnesota. So we've actually looked at putting money into the bonding bill and other sources to purchase these lands, because many times they're parcels inside of other publicly owned lands, and to try to unite those properties again into one parcel. And so there's a lot of work that's ahead of this commission, but nonetheless, the work has begun, and I'm very excited to be able to be a part of that, as well as you all should be as legislators as well.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you. I guess this is my annual comment about this topic. Just to remind committee members, once again, that the overwhelming number of sections of land, 16 and 36, I believe, that we're talking about here, that generates money to educate every kid in every district in every community throughout the state, the overwhelming preponderance of that land is located in northern Minnesota. Secondly, the two activities that generate the overwhelming amount of money to educate your kids comes from two activities: mining, digging holes in the earth and extracting minerals, and logging, sustainable forest practices to provide you with toilet paper and newspaper and everything else that you need. So, we can admire this all we want, but if you really and truly want to generate more money out of the trust to do more educational purposes for kids, then you have to stand up and say, we need to dig more holes and we need to cut more trees.
Amen.
Don't talk to us. Talk to them. We already know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
No. Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. My question was answered.
Wow. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, some of us did take advantage of an invitation and opportunity to do school trust land tours last summer. And I was one of those individuals that went on that. And just to follow up to Representative Erickson and Representative Grunhagen's statements, I quickly came up with the 2.5% because the trust is valued at about $1 billion and it's generating $25 million. So that's 2.5% return on the investment. The tour revealed that there are a little more than 1 million acres of school trust land. There was also some discussion about digging holes in the ground, and that the royalties on some of that extraction has the potential of contributing an additional $1 billion to the school trust fund. So, you know, that's something to consider. The thing to remember, too, with regard to the forestry aspect of it, is that forests are managed in terms of a crop is much different than we are used to in normal agricultural production, and they're managed for long-term yield. Obviously, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time's today, so it takes a generation oftentimes to get yield off of these acres. In closing, I would say the encouraging thing was is there's a new individual that appears to be managing on the part of the DNR, the school trust lands, and he also has a legal background, and I had the opportunity to have conversation with him, and I was impressed with his definition of the fiduciary responsibility of managing these lands, and being a trustee and a fiduciary is to manage the lands to the highest and best use to get the best return on that trust land. So I'm encouraged that that's exactly what has started to happen, rather than idly just kind of take the revenue or the change that comes in from time to time on logging leases and or other mechanisms. So I think there's a more active effort on the part of, and perhaps as a result of the past legislation, to actually be the best fiduciary for the school trust lands.
Representative Hertas, thanks for the update on that tour that I know was taken, and that sounds encouraging, your kind of take on things. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and many of us might recall during the discussions on this, there was land exchange, what's happened to the value. We did that evaluation of how well things were managed in the past and looking to the future, and part of what was done was to try and look at the land exchange and that we were getting a value back, as opposed to, as was sort of touched on, the state or other agencies within the state sort of giving us maybe a poorer parcel that wasn't as valuable as what we were giving up. So I was wondering if Chair O'Driscoll could make a little bit of statement or update on the progress of land exchange and if there's a policy the board is trying to establish there.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, that piggybacks off of the report that the DNR has put together, which have prioritized the lands and the purchase and the swaps of those kinds of things. Again, we're going to get a formal presentation. That's a part of the 48-page report that I have not had a chance to read yet. That hit the email at 10 o'clock. Globally, that is the goal and objective, is to prioritize those so that we can build it into a systematic plan so that if it's properties that are going to be kept and preserved because of the value that Representative Anzels is talking about for the kids, or if it makes sense to reunite parcels with other parcels and have the state purchase those, or if they happen to be those parcels of property that might abut bodies of water, which may be able to be used for recreational purposes or reunited to a state park, the state of Minnesota has to pay for those assets because they are the kids' assets. They're in trust, and we stand the risk of violating our fiduciary trust obligations, as Representative Hertas had mentioned. So that is a top priority of the commission, to know where those are at, and then to help work within the various bodies of the legislature and committees to help get support to be able to put the funding in a bonding bill or within an agency budget if it's something that they deem is appropriate and important asset preservation or classification for their needs or the greater needs of the people in the state of Minnesota.
Representative O'Driscoll, does the commission intend to hire a director, or where might they be at that?
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking that question. The legislation in 2012 does call for the governor to select and appoint an independent director that would be a part of the trust lands. Funds can be appropriated out of the trust lands to be able to support that position, as well as some other expertise that the director can hire and support staff. To this time, the governor has not made a selection on that. We do have legislation that if at some point, if it's the will of the chair, we'd like to have Representative John Benson, who's carrying that legislation on behalf of the commission, to come in to talk with you more about it, what the role would be, and to have a further discussion at some point if it's appropriate in front of the education committee. It has several stops to make, but since we're having that conversation today, there certainly seems to be interest by the members of this committee. We'd be happy to revisit that and to have a more of a formal informational hearing or formal hearing if you are open to that as well.
Very good. Thank you. Any closing comments, Representative O'Driscoll?
I would just like to leave folks with this. The state of Minnesota has several townships. If you think back in the early 1800s when the federal government survey was being done and this area was being surveyed into a government rectangular survey system, township after township, section after section, two sections in each of those townships were set aside. As Representative Anzell said accurately, sections 16 and 36 in each of those townships has been set aside. As the state has played out, some of those lands have been sold, bought, traded, and a majority of those assets now remain in northern Minnesota. As a matter of fact, later today, the President of the United States will land at the Minneapolis Airport, which part of that airport complex at one time was school trust land. So a little tie back to some history for Minnesota today on some trust lands. And again, as we've urbanized and as we've grown, those things have been bought, sold, or traded. And the majority of the value of the remaining assets are in northern Minnesota. So as has been the case in the past, greater Minnesota has benefited from some of the stuff that's happened on the metro, and now greater Minnesota will help the metro and other parts of Minnesota benefit as well. It's all just kumbaya.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Did I do a nice job of that, Representative? Did I? All right.
Thank you so much for the update and your work on that. And interesting, we're talking townships because many of us were at the township breakfast this morning also. So very good. Thanks for your work.
Thank you for your time. Yep. Thank you, committee, for your questions. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Before we move to the next item, we have a new page to introduce, and it is Emily Anton. So, Emily, any words of wisdom for the committee you'd like to share this morning? that's always a safe route. So, all right. Thank you and welcome aboard, Emily.
Welcome.
All right. At this time, as all of us know, when the bill last year left the education omnibus bill and we passed that off the House floor, a couple days later, maybe the next day, there was a tax bill that was also passed that carried a number of items that dealt with education. And so to kind of update all of us on what happened after it kind of left our purview, Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson, whoever who wants to carry that over that. So,
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. There's in your packet a memo addressed to Chair Marquardt. You asked me to summarize the school funding related provisions that were enacted in other bills this past year. We'll focus primarily on the tax bill in a few minutes. I've listed in the memo these the major provisions that were elsewhere just by chapter order. So that's the way the memo to you is sorted. And let me briefly talk about each of those, and then we'll spend a fair amount of time with the tax bill. In the public safety bill, there was a $455,000 appropriation to reinstate the school safety center. In the omnibus health and human services bill, there were increases, substantial increases in the amount for school-linked mental health grants. The increase was $2.5 million the first year and $4.9 million for fiscal years 15, and then that's built into the base at that higher level for out years. The way the memo's organized, the site, the statutory site or law site is listed, and then a quick summary of it. And then for those of you who want further information, I've tried to put some web links in that you could go to find more information about each of these programs funded elsewhere. In the permanent school fund bill, the issue we were just talking about with Representative O'Driscoll, there's a continuation of an ongoing appropriation from the permanent school funds for a suspense account to the DNR to accelerate land exchanges, which was an issue we were just talking about. There are a whole variety of issues regarding lands in other management areas such as state forests and lands in the boundary waters, all that kind of thing. There's a direct appropriation out of the forest suspense account of $200,000 per year to help the DNR move forward with some of those land exchanges. The link to the website there, to the DNR website, has a whole bunch of good information about the permanent school funds if you want to follow that link. And the new report hopefully should be indexed there now as well. The Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Funding Bill funds a variety of programs. And here each reader may decide that some of these are fitting our definition of school finance and others not so much. And there may be a few on the list that perform activities that are related to teachers and students that I didn't put here. But the main ones I wanted to highlight, the regional public library system receives $3 million per year out of Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy for certain programs. That's an account, essentially, in this committee that it watches over. Those grants aren't necessarily for school-age children. But because the regional library system is a budget item in this committee, I've put those on the list. We had a discussion last year in this committee about children's museums, and the K-12 bill has funding for two of the children's museums, small funding for two of the children's museums as a rider on the department budget. The Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy bill funds four children's museums listed by name and amount. Then the Purpich Center is another account of this committee. We have a line item appropriation for the Purpich Center. In addition to that, line item appropriation for arts and cultural heritage funding, the legacy folks put $795,000 per year into some arts integration grants through the Purpich Center. And then finally, for language immersion, for Dakota and Ojibwe language immersion programs, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Bill put $475,000 there. I've got a link to the website listed below that, and there's a lot more information there about the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The next several provisions, then, are all from the tax bill. And these are the changes that I think perhaps are most likely to generate conversation in this committee. A couple of these are smaller, and the referendum equalization change and location equity change is the biggest one that we'll spend the most time with. But I'll just so maybe I'll do that last and go through the other three first. The tax bill increased the funding for the Monoman School District. There's a line item annual appropriation in the tax bill for $70,000 per year that was increased to $140,000 for the Monoman School District to help that district deal with the loss of tax base when their casino property was removed from the tax base a number of years ago. skipping the referendum equalization provision for a minute. There were also a variety of taconite changes that were contained in the tax bill. Those changes had three effects on school districts. The first of those was the general regular school fund taconite money was increased by about $3 million per year through the through a higher tax on the production tax on the taconite. Then starting in fiscal year 15, the taconite referendum aid is also increased by about $3 million per year. And then finally, there was authority granted for the IRRRB to sell up to $38 million in bonds for distribution to the taconite area school districts for certain capital projects. So then, Mr. Chair, the big change was in Article 3 of the tax bill, and this had to do with two programs, the referendum equalization program and a new program called location equity revenue. And let me briefly talk about those, and then we'll go through the printout that's in your packet on these changes. The tax bill on the Senate side, when it came into conference committee this past year, included a provision that would substantially increase the equalizing factor for the first $300 of referendum revenue per pupil, and secondly would allow the school boards to approve up to $300 of referendum authority. Those provisions were adopted, and with those provisions, the House in the conference committee argued in favor of including location equity revenue. And location equity revenue, essentially what that does is create an additional category of general education funding, and if a school district has referendum authority, they simply move money from their referendum authority to the location equity category of revenue. If they don't have location or referendum authority, then the school board essentially is eligible for additional revenue under the location equity revenue. The location equity revenue was split into two chunks. The first of those was school districts with any part of them in the metropolitan area, not just their home office, but having any land located in the seven-county metro area, were eligible for $424 per pupil of location equity revenue. The other school districts in the state that are more than 2,000 students were eligible for $212 per pupil. And when we get to the printout, we'll go through how that worked. But essentially what happened is for some school districts, location equity was additional revenue. For others, there was an equalization benefit. And for other districts, there was a benefit for essentially making room under the referendum revenue cap. And we'll talk about those as we go through the printout. And lastly, on this issue of the referendum cap, when the added equalization was added and the change in the pupil weights and a few other things, the referendum cap was adjusted. All districts that are not eligible for sparsity, that is all districts subject to the cap, are now subject to the same cap, which is estimated for the next school year at $1,845 per pupil. And that amount then will increase by the rate of inflation, but instead of having separate caps now for those districts that are capped, there's the one referendum cap. With that, Mr. Chair, maybe we should move to the printout real quick.
Yes, please.
And I'll go through the categories on that, and then we can talk about questions that members may have on these. Okay. So what I'd like to focus...
Mr. Strom, just Representative Radenovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got to join Representative Anzalis at a meeting here very shortly, and so I was just wondering if I could get a quick question asked. In the location equity program, you know, obviously the seven county metro schools are entitled to $424, and the rural schools with the enrollment over 2,000 are $212. My question is it the boards have the authority to only take that amount, or may they take up to that amount?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Radenovich, they could take, as I understood it, they could take up to that amount. They it's essentially a negative checkoff on that one. Unlike the board action on referendum, which the district had to take an action on, if they didn't take action on location equity, the full amount was transferred to the location equity category. So for districts that didn't make an action, the full amount went into location equity for them. And generally speaking, it's to districts' financial advantage in a couple of different ways to move all the money into location equity that they can. And I believe there were only two districts that chose not to move some of their money into location equity. And at least one of those, the rationale was there was a referendum election, and they didn't want to have added confusion for their taxpayers when reapproving the referendum.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Mr. Radenovich,
quick follow-up.
Representative Radenovich.
So my question is, then, you sort of alluded to it, there were only two school districts that opted not to take advantage of the program. Do you have a sense of how many took full advantage of the program versus how many may have rolled over, like an existing voter referendum or anything like that?
Yeah.
Mr. Strom.
Chair, if we jump just ahead to the printout here and answer Representative Radenovich's question, and then maybe we'll get into the printout in detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can take it with me, and I'll check it out myself.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
Very good. So, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Strom.
So, Mr. Chair, if members would turn to the printout now that says estimated board-approved referendum, it's this one here, oriented landscape style. What the printout tries to do is summarize which districts by class benefited from each of these changes in the tax bill. And so there's a totals line at top, and then there are five summary lines grouping the state into Minneapolis and St. Paul, into metro suburban districts other than Minneapolis-St. Paul, school districts of more than 2,000 and school districts of less than 2,000 in greater Minnesota. And then none of these provisions affected charter schools, so they're on here just so the pupil count balances. But if you read across mainly on the summary lines first, you can see that there are two school districts in Minneapolis and St. Paul, 57 metro districts. Usually we use that count of 48, but because the location equity says if any part of the district is in the metro area, that brought in an extra 11 districts. So there's 57 metro districts. There are 46 districts with more than 2,000 pupils in greater Minnesota and 232 pupils with less than 2,000 pupils in greater Minnesota. So the first action of the tax committee on the board-approved referendum essentially gave school districts that did not have referendum authority the authority to adopt up to $300 by board approval. And you can see here that when we measure, and it gets a little complicated because of the elections last fall, but if we measure those that did not have any authority in the spring of 2013 for fiscal year 14 and those that do have authority now for fiscal year 15, there's $16.8 million that was approved by board action. The next column shows that amount per pupil, and the next column is the count. So on the referendum amount, $16.8 million was approved by board action. That averages $18 per pupil statewide. And in terms of the number of districts, 56 districts got some benefit from being able to approve $300 per pupil of additional authority. This is new revenue to school districts. It's a mix of aid and levy. That first $300 was equalized in the tax bill at a very high level, so most districts are going to get some share of that $300 as equalization aid, but there is also a levy component as well. And then you can see how that's distributed. There was just one district in the suburban metro area that benefited by that provision. In other words, only one metro district had less than $300 per pupil of authority. In greater Minnesota, 29 districts benefited by that in schools with more than 2,000 pupils. Seven districts benefited by that for the $5.5 million. And then for those with less than 2,000 pupils, there was a total of $11.1 million approved in 48 districts for an average of $65 per pupil.
Mr. Strom, could you just, while we're on this, talk just a little bit quickly about the referendum equalization and kind of what the difference actually meant in terms of, because a lot of districts were able to go out with the same amount of dollars and yet have, you're hearing this, we'd still reduce taxes because of this equalization. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, members, so the referendum prior to the changes in the tax bill was divided into two tiers. And the first tier was the first $700 per pupil, and under the old law, that was equalized at a at just a little below the state average tax base per pupil on market value tax base per pupil. So many districts got relatively little or no equalization on that first tier because their property values were high enough that didn't provide them additional assistance. When that equalizing factor was increased from the $476,000 per pupil to $880,000 per pupil, that meant that a lot more state aid went to school districts on that first $300 and less levy was required on that first $300. So for many school districts, that increase in aid was enough to lower their overall taxes on their referendum, even if they approved a larger amount of referendum. And that happened in a number of the cases where districts were asking for additional referendum revenue authority this past fall, but ended up with a higher referendum than before and lower levies because there was more equalization aid. So that first tier, that first $300 per pupil provided quite a bit more state aid per pupil.
Thank you.
And if you look down the columns, then you can see the amount that the board approved and the dollars per pupil. For most districts, that was $300. There were a few districts where that was a slightly different amount. If you look on the first page at Foley, for example, they only approved $21 per pupil. Essentially, that was because they had $280. Foley's District 51, they already had $280 of authority. So giving their board the authority to approve $300 just meant a $20 advantage for them. But for most districts, you'll see that did not have any referendum, they'll have the full $300. For those that had less than $300 of authority prior to this change, the amount they approved here pushed them up to that $300 level. So that's the first category of new revenue for school districts in the tax bill. That was about $16.8 million. 56 districts got additional revenue out of that. When we talk about the referendum a little later, we can look into detail at the added benefit of the equalization aid. A lot more districts benefited because of the higher equalization. Then the second group of changes happened with the location equity revenue provision that was adopted by the tax committee. And here there were two sets of effects, and these are shown in the second set of columns and the third set of columns. The first of those was a revenue effect. School boards in the metropolitan area, in addition to the $300 that was approved, board-approved referendum authority, could also approve another $424 if they were in the metro area, or if they were larger than 2,000 pupils in Greater Minnesota, approve $212 per pupil. This meant this is new revenue for those that were below those limits. So $724 of total referendum authority in the metro area, and $512 in Greater Minnesota. If you were below those levels and qualified for location equity, you could have up to that total amount between the board approved referendum and location equity. So again, if we look at the summary data here, 33 districts got additional money because of the location equity provisions, additional revenue to spend. It did not affect Minneapolis and St. Paul. You can see the revenue was nearly evenly split between the Greater Minnesota districts and the with more than 2,000 pupils and the metro suburban districts, and part of the reason why this is the case is because this expansive definition of the metro area picked up a number of districts that border the metro area that we don't usually think of as metro, and that partly explains that split being nearly half metro and not. And you can see 15 metro area districts and 18 Greater Minnesota districts benefited from that additional revenue. So this is new money for those districts to spend because of location equity. There's a second benefit to location equity, and that is for districts with higher amounts of referendum. Because the equalizing factor on location equity revenue was set at the same amount as the second tier of referendum, for a number of districts, this was additional tax relief for them. It wasn't additional money to spend, but it was additional savings because money that otherwise would have been in the third tier of referendum now gets equalized at the same rate as the second tier. So in the last set of columns, you'll see this effect. You'll see that there's $17.2 million of additional aid and tax savings to these districts. 36 districts were affected by this in total. And you can see here, as you look by the categories of districts, St. Paul was a large beneficiary of this. They were able to move a fair amount of their referendum into the location equity column and benefit by the higher equalization in that category. Then the suburban metro were the next group. 25 districts in the suburban metro area received additional tax relief and added state aid, equalization aid, because of the location equity program. And 10 districts in greater Minnesota received an additional $1.4 million in additional aid and lower property taxes because of location equity revenue. So in terms of the changes in the tax bill, those first two columns, the board-approved referendum affected 56 districts, 16.9 million. The location equity revenue affected 33 districts for 17 million. And then additionally, the location equity tax relief affected another 36 districts. And finally, Mr. Chair, as you mentioned at the beginning, there is also, because of the higher first-tier equalization for any district with a tax base below $880,000 per pupil, there was some benefit on the first $300 being equalized at that higher level. And those are the changes, the primary changes that were included in Article 3 of the tax bill.
I have one clarification, then Representative Plum has a question on this last one, location equity property tax relief. So what I'm thinking here is originally that $476,000 in the first tier, did that go up to $500? Or how many dollars of pupil units was that?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately for computational sakes, perhaps good for other purposes, we changed pupil weightings last year. And the net result of adding the kindergartners into the pupil count and then reducing the secondary pupil weightings and reducing the elementary pupil weightings to one meant that we have about 7% fewer pupils than we did, funding pupil units, than we did when we left this committee last year. Mm-hmm. If you look in the very first column there, the adjusted pupil units at 917,000, that was more like 950,000, 980,000 when it left committee last year. And so all of the numbers are adjusted by this 7%. So the $476,000 equalizing factor is equivalent to the new $510,000 equalizing factor under the new lower pupil weights, higher equalizing factor because there's lower pupil count, and so everyone's value per pupil went up a little bit.
And Mr. Stroman, the old law, that first tier went up to how many
Mr. Chair, the first tier went up to $700 per pupil. Under the new law, the first tier is $300, and then up to $760 is the second tier. So that $760 is about equivalent to the $700. So that where the first tier used to end is now where the second tier ends. So really, $760 is equivalent to $700.
And so on that last column where those districts are picking up the property tax relief, is that what was at one time into the second tier at the old $290,000 is now at the old 476 or the 510.
Yes, and that's exactly, Mr. Okay. Chair. That was at the lowest tier, the 270,000 before, is now at what would be the equivalent at 290,000. And by moving money out of the old second tier, which is now the third tier, into the new second tier, provides that tax savings.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I have had quite a few courses in math and grad and undergrad and science, a couple of the unit descriptors escape me. I'm trying to get some clarification. What does a lot and what does many mean? When I look at the columns, the first set has about 1 in 7 of districts. The second and third are about 1 in 10 districts. So I'm trying to quantify in my type of terms, I can understand what a lot of districts and what many districts mean.
Mr. Chair, those poorly chosen words on my part. Perhaps a few and some would be better. Under the old pupil weighting.
Nicely done. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what would be the descriptor for in the second and third sets of columns where in greater Minnesota school districts of less than 2,000 adjusted pupil units have zero? What is that description? Is it just because they're not located I noticed location is part of the is the first word in these titles, so that just means that if you're a small school and you're not located in the metro counties, that you don't really show up.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to what was in the conferees' minds on the text conference committee last year, but yes, that essentially meant that there was no benefit for any greater Minnesota district with less than 2,000 students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Wills, and then Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the overview and explanation, and I just had a couple of questions. And I'm noticing in the breakdown here that the intermediate school districts aren't listed, and I was wondering if that fell into one of the categories listed here or if we have any numbers on that. That was my first question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, the intermediate school districts were not affected by these provisions. They don't have a board-approved referendum, nor do they qualify for location equity. So there's no effect at all on the intermediates by the location equity revenue or the changes to the referendum revenue.
Okay. Thank you for that. And just a quick second question. I was wondering if there were any school districts that were negatively affected by these changes.
Mr. Strom?
I'm trying to be careful here. I don't think there is. The one area where a district could have been negatively affected, the new referendum cap, there were a half dozen districts that were that were still subject to the referendum cap that were grandfathered in at their old levels. And the new referendum cap is $1,845. But I think all five or six of those districts actually benefited by having the location equity revenue rolled out. So I think they were not negatively affected by the cap essentially being as a percentage of the formula allowance being lower than what it was before. So I think it's the case that there was no district that was negatively affected. The other reason I'm stumbling a little bit on this is there's a component of revenue separate from these in the general education formula called equity revenue. And equity revenue is determined by the ratio of your referendum compared to where all other districts in the state are. And because location equity takes some of the higher folks out of the lowers their referendum a bit, it changes that ratio in there. And so it may be the case that there's a district, if we went back and said let's rerun everything and not have location equity moved out, how much equity revenue did they get, and are they getting less than that now? There may be a district where there was a very small difference in the amount of equity revenue they're getting. So I think I'd feel uncomfortable saying no, that there isn't anybody that was affected by it, but the effect would be relatively small on the equity revenue if there were a negative effect, assuming all other things in last year's bill, were held harmless.
Thank you for the explanation.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Marker. Yeah, I just, just give you a little feedback on the ramifications of some of this. I got my home district at GSL. They had two or three townships, I can't remember exactly, that were in the seven-county metro area. So they got full location equity aid. Another neighboring district happened to be in Sibley County, McLeod East. They didn't have any townships in Seven County, and they could desperately need it. They experienced declining enrollment. They've got a number of shortfalls. So, my advice to them was to annex one township out of the Seven County metro area so they get their location equity aid, okay? I mean, and just one follow-up here as far as feedback. We met with the area superintendent, Senator Newman, Representative Erdahl and myself, and include Hutchison, Glencoe, and some of the Sibley County districts. But their unanimous response by the superintendents was, a student is a student is a student, okay? we should be funding them equally and not making up all these separate categories to complicate. You know, I'm thinking if somebody watched this, if a citizen taxpayer parent out there watched this committee meeting on TV, which are we on TV? I don't think we are.
Right? I don't know if we're on today.
Hi, Mom. Okay. How would they even understand what just got explained? You know what I mean? I've got the printouts in front of me, and I at least half a chance because I've had 16 years of looking at these things, okay? But, it gets to the point where it becomes convoluted, and I'm not blaming anybody in particular. I'm just saying let's try to simplify this and treat students equally in terms of the funding and the educational opportunities they have, whether they're in northern Minnesota, central Minnesota, whether they're in the metro area, or wherever they're at. So that's the feedback I'm giving you, and it's basically from my superintendents. And so you can take that for food for thought.
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We are actually going to get to that point kind of after this, where hopefully if members want to share some of the things they're hearing from superintendents. But the first issue on the metro versus rural, we had a little bit of that discussion in this committee last year. Remember when Elk River was before us and they didn't have their district office in the metro area, but their schools were something. I do think we need to look at that, because it seems just by geography you fall into one area or the other. And I do think there is probably, talking even with the St. Michael Albertville type of school districts, that I don't know if it's the most fair system the way we have that on what determines what's a metro. So I think that's an issue to talk about. And kind of the other area where, a student is a student is a student is, that is, you look at the underlying basis of our funding system. We have said that every district has somewhat of a unique situation. And so, you've got compensatory aid because we're saying schools that have a greater percent of students in poverty need extra dollars, and we've said that holds merit. Or we've said various rural communities that are more sparse deserve extra funding because there's extra costs, and we say there's merit in that. So some people, of course, depending on what school district you're from, say, hey, let's just throw all that out and just fund, of course that's where they would benefit. But getting back to our goal as a committee is to close the achievement gap. So what's the best way? And we can certainly have that discussion, but I think we all would realize that a one-size-fits-all wouldn't work for that if we truly wanted to target down into how to get that achievement gap solved. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mark.
And then Representative Herthaus and Representative Reinert.
Yeah, and during our comments and our input later on, I understand, I do have a one-size-fits-all solution for the achievement gap, okay? From input from teachers and number of other educational professionals.
Okay. Thank you.
And it doesn't cost, and then we can fund everybody equally, okay?
Very good. Representative Herthaus and then Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on the comments that you made as well as Representative Grunhagen, I agree it is convoluted and it's very difficult for the average citizen to understand. And maybe we shouldn't be surprised, because as we sit in committee and listen to every school district, it's not me. I'm unique. We're different. And so because you recognize the fact that everybody's different, lend support to the notion that a lot of this is maybe best handled at the local level, and that school districts are uniquely local. With regard to your comments about the location equity, I think it was a reasonable and a proper thing to do, because many of these school districts around the metro area happen to have their district office located just outside of that geographic border. And many of the school districts actually were considering expending resources to move the district office within the metro so that they did qualify for the dollars. So I think it was a prudent thing to do. They could qualify if they made those changes, but why waste those resources in having school dollars spent to move a district office on the other side of a county line? So personally, on behalf of the school districts in my district that were positively affected by that, I will bring and carry a message of thank you to the committee and to the accomplishment of that end.
Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure Representative Erickson or Mr. Strom could go into this in much greater detail, but if Representative Greiling were here, she'd give you the whole history of how we came to this point. And I think, well, understanding that what we now are calling location equity revenue was initially proposed as a location equity index to look at cost differentials like housing costs, costs of living in various districts, and how that factored into negotiations and the cost of hiring your staff and supporting an equivalent staff. And all districts aren't created equal in that regard. And it really, Governor Pawlenty started all this in the early, in his administration, and trying to look at the real cost of educating a student and having that quantified. And this proposal came out of that. Whether or not we agree with how the tax committee applied it, I think, is a challenge to this committee, because it became an equivalent stream instead of an index that was based on cost. So I think that is up to us to really examine more closely. But I think recognizing the history and the whole context of formula reform is an important piece of information for members of this committee.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Representative Breinart on bringing up the cost differential as part of the basis for this location discussion and why it was set up. And frankly, there was some analysis of the cost across the state, and there happens to be a little place outside of the metro that has a similar cost differential, has the third largest city in the state, has the largest private employer in the state, has greater than the average diversity in the state, has greater than 70 languages being spoken in the homes of students, within that area, that isn't considered, isn't covered in the seven county. And I see, depending on what area you're talking, it's seven county, 11 county, etc. I think Mr. Representative Gruenhagen wouldn't mind there being a 56 county metro for some of this stuff. But frankly, and Representative Norton has a bill to try and address this minor oversight that neglected the third largest city in the state and all these and also we did try to include them in some things, but frankly sometimes it seems as if it's the location or whose district has a greater effect in the generation of these formulas than what we're here for. We're here for the students. Frequently it's students in the future because of what we're doing, but hopefully we can also do something for the students that are there in the classroom now. And as we look at the convolution here, I do hope that we can come up with something that's simpler and more straightforward and that focuses first on those students and not where they live, but what they need to succeed and achieve, so they're not just filling a seat until they reach their maturity date and move on, that they are progressing and being given the tools to make it, so that we look at all these little variations and we seem to lose the forest and the trees on what we need to focus on, which is providing the students what they need when they become adults. Thank you.
And for those watching on television, if we were on television, that city is Rochester. That was referred to many times over. So thank you, Representative Kwan.
They were good clues.
They were very good. Mr. Strom, anything further you want to cover on?
Mr. Chair, the number of, I would just add, the number of changes made last year to things like the pupil weighting and the way that this location equity and the board-approved referendum worked have really made it difficult for us to try and make good comparisons for you, and we'd be happy to try, Ms. Johnson and I'd be happy to try and repackage this information in other ways for members, because we know it's a lot stuffed into a small space here. But it really does take some sussing out and some assumptions to try and isolate just the effects of those changes from last year.
Very good. All right, and I'm sure we'll come back and revisit some of these issues as the year goes on. At this time, we've got about 25 minutes left. I'm not going to require, if you don't want to, but if anyone wants to provide some comments that they're hearing back in the district, I know Representative Grunhagen was nice enough to share some of his comments from what he's hearing, but if any members would like to talk about that, and Representative Hertaus.
A little more than 2 weeks ago, we had a conference of our school superintendents. About 11 districts are, 11 different school districts are in our Senate District 33, or serve that area. And majority of the school superintendents were able to attend, and they have particular concerns about the unfunded mandates of the proposed bullying bill, and the overwhelming consensus is that they do not want this.
And I appreciate, and we're not going to be, you know, we're not going to discuss any of this and so forth, but just bring that up. I appreciate that. And I just will say I've heard that also from I had a meeting of superintendents, and they're very appreciative of the extra dollars that they received. It's kind of pull them out of the hole in the all-day kindergarten and the equalization, which allowed them to do some things they haven't been able to do. But probably the one overriding is what you said, is kind of what are the costs of some, you know, the teacher evaluation and some of this other stuff that is coming down the road.
Oh, there is one other comment.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you. With a lot of the special programs that the school districts, and this is perhaps a policy issue more than finance, but the current system where they are going through a quite an extensive search to find a specialized teacher to provide classroom instruction for some of their program and curriculum, they find it extraordinarily difficult when faced with a situation of having to cut a staff position that it's, you know, last in, first out kind of situation, and that it seems redundant, and they were really begging on how we can come up with some type of a system to allow retention of that most qualified teacher for that task without having to let them go when school districts are faced with that challenge.
Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't spend a long time on this, but Mankato Area Public Schools annually invites all the legislators who serve that school district to the table, and they have a legislative committee made up of parents, staff members, administrators, you know, community members, and they create their own legislative priorities and platform. And first of all, the thing I heard first and foremost was thank you for the funding for all-day kindergarten and early childhood. They were very grateful for that. They're a district that's funded all-day kindergarten for a number of years on their own, so it certainly freed up some other elements in their budget you know, for them to do other things. But a few of the things that they raised are things we've heard here last session. Extend funding for English learners from 5 years to 7 years. That's been an issue that's been on our table. Roll health and safety revenue into the deferred maintenance formula, increasing the allowance from $64 to $230 per pupil unit for districts that do not qualify for alternative facilities. The school year calendar, the proverbial start date, they've been a longtime advocate for letting districts make that choice themselves. And continuing to identify funding for mental health resources. They're appreciative of the grants that came out of Health and Human Services, but grants don't really create a sustainable funding model, and mental health for students is a high priority. There were some concerns, again, about the administrative aspects of the bullying bill. Great support for the goals and broad model, but issues around how it would be administered at the local level.
Thank you. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my district that I represent is District 196, and so it's Eagan, Apple Valley, and Rosemount, and I actually only represent half of it because it's the fourth largest district in the state. So I have the Apple Valley-Rosemount portion, and my story from my superintendent there, Jane Behrens, is similar to what Representative Breinert shared about the legislative council that our district has and getting citizens involved in the legislative process and what we can do here at the state level to help our district. So I had the chance to sit down with my superintendent yesterday morning and go over some of her thoughts and what the goals are for our district. And I'll first start with a few of the items from the last session that were especially helpful for our district that were passed into law. And it was the all-day kindergarten. Our district had been paying for it, or not paying for it, but requiring parents to pay for it at a fee already. And so this really helps the parents in our district. On the downside, though, it will be requiring our district to have 21 more classrooms for this fall to be able to fully implement because of the demand. So they have concerns as far as funding for that because now that they don't have the parental fee coming in, they're looking to hopefully get an increase in the lease levy and broaden the scope to give them more flexibility to be able to fund to have space for all-day kindergarten and preschool. And the preschool scholarships was another piece that they really appreciated. And then a couple other items that were mentioned were the equalization really helped our district and being able to reinstate the integration funding. Our district uses that funding for magnet schools, and it's been very successful in closing the achievement gap in our district. And so I've been really encouraged to see the work that they're doing there. And then also, the bullying bill has already been mentioned, and we talked about that a little bit, and my superintendent shared her concerns with the definition that she's concerned it's too broad, and that we should look at tightening that up. And I understand we're not going to necessarily be addressing that in the House, and it's more on the Senate's plate right now, but I think it's important for us to be aware of that. And then she had a concern with the training of volunteers and the burden that would be on the school district, especially when they have a volunteer who only comes in to help out for 1 hour out of the whole school year. So some issues to be looked at there. And then just kind of a broad goal that they have in the upcoming session is focusing on having fewer mandates and greater local control and recognizing that the local school district is the best making the decisions that work for the students in that district. And so with that, they're looking at hopefully having increased local authority and flexibility on the use of the compensatory revenue and reducing burdensome special education paperwork and reporting requirements. And they also would like to be able to not have to be required to post the meeting minutes and budget information in a local newspaper. And then in the electronic age, there's several ways to access that information, and maybe that's a little outdated. So that's one thing that they mentioned. And then one local project that we're looking at doing is creating a one-time exemption for the lease levy funds to be able to purchase a transportation facility for our buses. Right now, we only have one location. And the lease levy dollars are not allowed to be used to purchase this kind of a building. But if we can purchase a second building, it would alleviate the routes and the time used to go pick up the students. And it's estimated that our district would actually be able to save about $500,000 if we move forward with this. And then the Minnesota Department of Education also estimated that they would save about $163,000 to $180,000 if we were able to do this, because right now our district is using contracted bus services, and there's a reimbursement piece there with the Minnesota Department of Education. So there's already legislation introduced for that. Representative with the Minnesota Department of Education. So there's already legislation introduced for that. Representative Halverson, I believe, is the chief author here in the House, and then our Senator Greg Claassen is carrying the Senate jacket. So I'm hoping that that can get looked at on this session, and we can help alleviate the costs for our district. So that's just broad overview. There's always so much going on in our district, and it's been an honor to represent such a wonderful school district.
Well, thank you. Your superintendent's well represented, so thank you so much for bringing those items forward.
Thanks for the time.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a little input for you. I am a little bit of a supporter of yous out in my local district. As I said, one thing about the K-12 Finance Committee, I like and respect the chair. He is very supportive of open and robust debate, and he's not afraid to listen to comments that he may not agree with completely. Now, having said that, I've got about 25 items I'd like to do.
Representative Morgan.
I'll cut it down to four, okay? First, let's talk about the achievement gap just briefly. There is a group, and it's, by the way, it's bipartisan, that is looking to address dyslexia. Some of you are probably aware of it, and it's been up here at the Capitol. And one of the things that they brought out, the group was able to meet with the Commissioner of Education here, and I happened to attend that meeting. And one of the things that have been brought out, and by the way, the group isn't just parents, it's school teachers, concerned parents, and other educational personnel. But one of the things that was brought out at the meeting that I just wanted to share with the group is that in our teacher first, the teaching of intensive systematic phonics, and they didn't use those words, but I do, has shown to improve child reading skills at every single level. Now, they used the word decoding and phonogram and those things, but it was a clear emphasis that intensive systematic phonics, learning the consonant and vowel sounds for children, improves their reading levels, shrinks the achievement gap. And these, by the way, this group has representatives from Rochester, Winona, and several other areas. And again, some of these are teachers that have actually seen these results. The second thing they brought out is that our teacher colleges do not teach future teachers how to instill decoding into the students. They exclude that from the teacher colleges. So that's a major problem in our teacher educational system that we have currently. So I'm excited about that. By the way, the dyslexia affects over 60 million people in our country, students and adults. 60 million. I think it's one out of four or one out of five. From my perspective, you know, the study I've done, whole language has a huge part in creating dyslexia diagnosis in our students. And that, unfortunately, whether through basal literature or pure whole language, is the predominant reading technique that's being promoted in Minnesota schools today. So I hope we're open to listening to this bipartisan group. I think it can greatly reduce the achievement gap as far as our students are concerned without spending millions and millions of additional dollars. Okay, that's number one.
Representative Grunhagen, I know you've had a chance to speak earlier. We've got five others on the list with about 11 minutes to go.
Real quickly, I'll do it in a minute left. Second thing, front page article at our GSL school district, very disappointed with the elimination of the grad standard. Okay, they believe it's dumbing down, and I was going to bring a copy of the article along. They believe it's dumbing down the system, and you're going to get a lot more graduations, but we have no cut score or way of measuring whether those graduations are actually helping or not. Again, we're returning to social promotion, and that's a disservice, in my opinion, to the students in the state of Minnesota. The other thing just mentioned quickly, they don't like unfunded mandates, the bullying bill, but more importantly, one of the things I found out, and I got a copy of the curriculum, it's perfectly normal, is that our obscenity laws in the state of Minnesota do not apply to our public schools. And this type of curriculum, which is currently in 19 school districts, or 19 schools, some elementary, and 12 school districts, all the way down to 10 years old, if you were to show this book to a 10-year-old off public school site, you could be charged with our obscenity laws in the state of Minnesota. So I have a bill to apply the obscenity laws to public schools so we can get rid of some of this trash that's being taught to our children. The title of this book should be changed from It's Perfectly Normal to It's Perfectly Perverted, because the types of sexual behavior that they promote to our elementary students, which we know from peer-reviewed studies damages them intellectually, psychologically, and emotionally, should not be allowed in this state or anywhere else. So I have a bill. I'd like it to be bipartisan, and just ask members to consider signing on to this. The Minnesota Child Protection League says that this type of curriculum would be mandated under the current bullying bill, and that is great consternation to my school districts, my parents, school board members, and also to myself. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My school districts, and I represent three large suburban school districts, Lakeville Area Schools, the Rosemont, Eagan Apple Valley Schools, with Representative Wills, and the Burnsville School District, all very much appreciative of the new funding they're receiving, especially for all-day kindergarten, which for two of them will start this coming school year. The Burnsville Schools actually implemented all-day kindergarten free for everyone year before this, so the 12 and 13 school year, and they were using their compensatory funding to pay for that. The Burnsville School District has a about 50% free and reduced lunch. They thought that that was the best way they could use those funds to close the achievement gap, so they are now very excited that they're going to be able to repurpose those compensatory funds that they had been using for the all-day K into other programs to help, again, reduce the achievement gap, especially with their relatively high levels of poverty for a suburban school district. Two of the school districts, the Lakeville Schools and the Rosemont School District, went out for a property tax levy last fall, and they passed overwhelmingly. And one of the reasons they believe they passed overwhelmingly, Lakeville Schools had, I think, for the last 10 years, tried to pass additional property tax levies and it never passed. One of the reasons they believe that they passed overwhelmingly was because of the work we had done with the equalization that made the cost of going out for those levies lower to the local taxpayers. So those are some of the things that I've heard back from the districts I represent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that the people in my district are very excited that the school shift has been paid back, and that is a big topic of conversation. I won't dwell on some of the things that other people have mentioned. All-day K, early childhood scholarships are very welcome, and the increase of funding to the general fund. My superintendents, I represent three school districts, Minnetonka, Hopkins, and Eden Prairie, and their legislative citizen action groups are very happy that we're moving to a suite of assessments that is predictive of future post-secondary success, and they are thrilled that what they see as a vote of confidence in local control, that if students are passing tests in local classes, that shows mastery of the skills. There is some concern around the Safe and Supportive Schools Act. How is that going to be implemented, though they are supportive of the goals? And since all three of my districts are QCOMP districts, they are excited about the new teacher evaluation, but are worried about systems that they already have in place that are improving student achievement. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, will be brief. our district's very supportive of this world's best workforce. Superintendent Carlson mentions that all the time, and he refers to WBWF and confuses me because I think of all of the acronyms in the Health and Human Services. I wonder what he's talking about. One of the things that we're concerned with, and we've been working with an Oak Ramsey Community College on, is our barriers to early college learning, in trying to meet this world's best workforce, that we have some things to work out with the community colleges, PSEO, that sort of thing. Formula increase in our district, it didn't cover our inflationary costs. They run about 2.5%, and we received 1.9% on the formula. So the district dipped into the reserve for over $7 million, which takes our reserve dangerously low. And we're in the middle of negotiations now with our teachers union that puts a crimp on a lot of things. Very supportive of the early or the all-day K and early learning, and they are concerned in the district that we try to get some of the early learning funding to the schools and focus on schools for early learning. But that's also on the anti-bullying bill. In our district, we've gone through a prolonged court legal issue on bullying and had to come up with a new policy. And there's concern there that our policy might conflict somewhat with Representative Daphne's bill. So.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, on behalf of my taxpayers, property taxes have increased. On the school side, there was basically a wash, a voter-approved reduced and board-approved increased, so that was a wash. But ag land values increased, and green acres has caused a huge problem in my area, so that's my statement on the taxpayer's side. From the school district's concern about the donut hole, the bullying bill, don't want it, don't need it, because we have good stuff in place. And finally, will we hear the School Facilities Task Force report? Because I have school districts interested in those recommendations, which I think we should take a careful look at.
Thank you. And Representative Erickson, next Wednesday we're going to hear that report. Representative Bernardi. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Newton and I were discussing here. He shared the Anoka Hennepin stuff, so I'll skip over that. And I'll share the Spring Lake Park information. Thank you for letting us do this. Our school districts were really pleased to share information with us. I'll go through them very quickly, but I do want to give them the time since they gave us their time in coming up with these. They were very excited about simplifying the pupil units and special education. It doesn't often get attention, but right. They really appreciate that. Also, the world's the WBWF, and they like that. The compensatory, they like that, the flexibility with it. The property tax relief was, it really showed the, I don't know if you want to say the unfairness or the burden that our school district and community has picked up and that hasn't been equitable, and it really made a difference in our community. And then school shift payback, obviously they're very happy about that. They said some needs, you never get all the best, you also get the needs. Yeah. And just briefly, the safe and secure school funding isn't keeping up with the need. They support the school facilities work group that came out. They have problems with paying for their facilities. It costs about 20 to 25 teachers a year if you make it equivalent to that. And one of our school districts doesn't qualify for our alternative facilities. So facility and maintaining them is a huge issue. The other thing is, lack of funding for teacher evaluation, as you know, and I've carried that bill to try to get some funding for that. And then early learning scholarships, getting the money to the school districts for that. Reducing early college readiness barriers like PSEO and getting IB to have more college credit when kids graduate. And then it was excellent amount of funding for the schools. It's still just barely keeping up with inflation. So,
thank you so much. And one more, our Vice Chair, Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very fast. I didn't go to my superintendents. I went to my teachers in both Richfield and Bloomington because they're the front line, and they see exactly where the money goes. Anyway, they were concerned about class size. They were delighted with the early childhood and the all-day K funding. They'd like to see their contracts settled in a timely way, which apparently now a number of districts are not settling and are drawing out the contract negotiations, and that's very very bad for morale. They'd like to see prep time as a priority so that they can prepare to teach kids and eliminate the achievement gap with better lessons. better prepared lessons. They'd like to have more community people out in the community involving families, and especially families of some of our more disenfranchised groups with language barriers and things like that, to bring them into the school, because that's a way they see to be able to work at the achievement gap also is involving families. They'd like to extend the ELL time from 5 to 7 years. I think Representative Breiner talked a little bit about that. Teacher evaluation done at the local level so it's meaningful and not kind of knee-jerk evaluation. Special ed paperwork is troublesome and lengthy and overdone. And they would like to, both districts had referendums, both districts passed the referendums, I'm happy to say. However, the teachers in Richfield in particular pounded lawn signs, knocked on doors, phoned, and did this kind of stuff, and they're saying to me, please, could we be like the city council? Could the school board re-up an existing referendum without having to go to the voters?
Right. Thank you very much. Members, all the procedures of the committee are going to stay the same as last year, but they are included in your packets. With that, thank you. We are adjourned.